Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, October 25th, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. Well, it's now official. There will be an emergency summit in Washington, D.C. on November 15th to discuss the accelerating disintegration of the global financial system. It appears at the moment unlikely, due to the presence of President Bush, that this meeting will deal seriously with the growing crisis, as Bush sort of has one foot out the door and his head's already in Crawford, Texas. But it's become increasingly obvious that there are only two choices available to leaders of the world in dealing with this crisis. Either there'll be an agreement to implement Lyndon LaRouche's proposal for a new Bretton Woods, modeled on the successful 1944 Bretton Woods plan initiated by U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, or there'll be a global financial fascist dictatorship based on the principles of Anglo-Dutch liberalism. The latter has been proposed by British Prime Minister Gordon Brown and has already been dubbed by some as the new Bretton Woods, and would protect the speculators at the expense of nations and their people. And you can go to LaRouchePact.com, where there's a very good little short on Bretton Woods versus Bretton Woods to give you an example of that, to give you some ideas on it. Now, LaRouche's plan centers on an agreement among four leading powers, the United States, Russia, India, and China, to go back to a treaty that is based on the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates, the idea of acting for the benefit of the other, the principle of the Peace of Westphalia, no speculation, no derivatives, and massive investment in major infrastructure projects. On today's program, we will review these two options with special attention to developments in Russia and India. Joining me to discuss this will be the longtime director of the Executive Intelligence Review Russia Desk, Rachel Douglas, and Ramtanu Maitra, who's EIR's New Delhi Director of Intelligence. And also joining us will be Michael Kirsch from the LaRouche Youth Movement, who is working with Rachel and on developing an expanded capability both on intelligence for Russia, but also organizing a youth movement inside Russia around LaRouche's ideas. Now, I'd like to begin the program with the review of recent economic developments in both Russia and India. I think most of our listeners are aware that the global financial markets have been crashing, headed toward the bottom, as we were just talking about whether the NASDAQ or the Dow Jones Index will be the first one to negative numbers. But there's also been a very profound effect on some of the fastest growing economies outside of the United States, which of course is crashing. But there's been an effect as well. So let's look at the Russia and India and see if there has been motion toward a new Bretton Woods option. So Rachel, obviously Russia has not been able to escape the effects of the global meltdown, as some of their leaders had hoped as recently as the summer they would be able to. So what is the general situation with the Russian economy, and is there some consensus forming around the idea of a new Bretton Woods?
Well, there's a lot of emergency action being taken within Russia, which fortunately is not limited to the kind of ineffective bailout approach that you have internationally, although there are components of that. That is, they're trying to keep the doors of their banks open over the last couple of weeks. But the rapid pace of events this summer has forced the issue. It's forced the Russian government to address actually a division that's been there within the leading circles really throughout this decade as Russia recovered from the Yeltsin years of unbridled speculation in the 1990s. If you recall, Harley, it was just 10 years ago that Russia defaulted in August of 1998, and that was not an internal Russian problem.
Not at all.
That was the result of the earlier wave of systemic crisis, of the breakdown of the post-1971 floating exchange rate system, in particular the activity of the big hedge funds, people like George Soros's Quantum Fund and other such institutions, smashed currencies in Asia. Hot money fled from Asia into Russia. Then Russia went into a speculative upward spiral, which then collapsed. They had a default. They had a devaluation of their currency massively, and were down to zero, down to nothing. And with the new government of Putin, first as prime minister, then as president, they began to recover over time. Now, as that process unfolded, certainly some useful things that the Putin governments launched, like resuscitating their nuclear program. You know, Russia has a program and an attitude that they're going to build 40 nuclear plants domestically and another 45 for export over the next 20, 25 years. Their transport perspective, some of the things we've talked about on earlier editions of the LaRouche Show. Mm-hmm. But all the while, the finance ministry in particular and some of the other institutions like the Russian Central Bank have been on the wavelength of central bankers everywhere.
So when you say there's a division, it's people like Kudrin and others who have been urging that Russia become part of the globalized system.
Yes, and insisting that if you just go by the rules of the game but do it a little bit better and seek to develop your competitive advantages, things will come out okay. And as you said, as recently as 6 months ago, the finance minister of Russia, Mr. Kudrin, was saying that even if there was turmoil in the United States or elsewhere, Russia would be a safe haven. And that money would stay in Russia. Well, that's not what's going on, because when the whole business froze up, credit was frozen, bank-to-bank transactions were frozen over the last month and a half, people who were desperate for cash pulled their money out of the Moscow markets, just as out of Brazil and various other so-called emerging markets.
Wasn't some of the illusion that with the high oil prices and natural gas prices and money flowing into Russia, that even if there were disruptions around the world, there'd still be income coming in from oil and gas?
In part, that has been there. And there's also been a fight over what you do with all those revenues. They have very large reserves. They have a stabilization fund, so-called. It's now in the process of being transformed into a sovereign wealth fund. But there's been huge resistance from this monetarist or neoliberal faction in the government to investing that internally, just on silly central banker-type arguments that, well, if you invest too much money in the economy, it'll cause inflation, completely ignoring that you can make a difference between a productive investment and an unproductive one.
Right.
So this crisis puts everything on the table, and it is useful that both Prime Minister Putin and his successor as president, Dmitry Medvedev, have at least to some extent been thinking, there's evidence, for the past couple of years in terms of, and they use the term, a new financial architecture. In fact, this year in June at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, it's an annual event in the city that's the native, it's the hometown for both men, Medvedev put out a warning that current financial relations are not adequate to the needs of our day, and that he said that he, Medvedev, advocated international consultations on a new financial architecture. He then tried to put that question on the agenda at the G8 meeting in Japan at the beginning of this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And his interlocutors were not all that interested in an in-depth discussion.
So that was in, you said June?
June. It was just before the volcanoes started erupting.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So Medvedev has been in a position where he has can say and does say, both to the Russian people. He actually gave a webcast yesterday to the Russian population in which he, very short 6-minute statement in which he contrasted their situation now compared with the situation in 1998. And by the way, emphasized that it is much bigger now. It is a different order of problem because the epicenter of the crisis is in the United States. But he's also, Medvedev, done things like change his schedule, jump on an airplane, and fly to Evian, France, in early October to consult with President Sarkozy of France on, again, this question of a new financial architecture. What the content of what the Russians are advocating under a new financial architecture, that's still open to discussion and debate.
Well, and I
we
want
can
to
talk
back
about
to that,
that more.
Yeah, I want to come back to that in a moment, but then clearly from what you've described, there is an awareness there. And I would like to hear from you the indications that as this awareness has deepened, there's been a LaRouche card being played, at least by some, inside the Russian political intelligentsia.
This is very much the case, and there's a background to the authority that Lyndon LaRouche enjoys in Russia right now. It goes back to the fact that he warned leading Russian circles from day one, from the moment the Soviet Union broke up in 1991, that what was happening to the Soviet system was the first shoe to drop, and that the second shoe to drop would be the the British center, the Anglo-American, or more scientifically, the Anglo-Dutch financial cartels and the system based on them, and that anybody who shaped their national economic policy according to the rules of the game of those cartels was going to have hell to pay down the road. So just in preparation for today's talk, I reviewed what's been in the Russian press just in the last 1 month, and it includes such items as September 16th, the business supplement of the Russian government newspaper, Rossiyskaya Gazeta, ran an article which was discussing that the problem today, and this is by their staff economics correspondent, the fellow who's written on economics for the government newspaper for years, that the problem today is the intrinsic flaws of the entire post-1971 floating exchange rate system. Halfway through this article, the author said, let us give you an elaborated view of the matter from the well-known American economist Lyndon LaRouche. And there followed a two-paragraph excerpt from a lecture which LaRouche had delivered in person in April 2004 during a visit to Moscow to students at the Moscow Academy of Finance and Law. And they quoted LaRouche saying, this is direct, "When we turned the world system into a floating exchange rate monetary system in 1971-72, the Anglo-American financier interest actually established a kind of imperial dictatorship over world finance." And then he went on to, end quote, he went on to describe, and they printed that, how the London market functions as a center of speculation and of financial slash political operations against various countries. So that was September 16th. Then you had LaRouche put on Russian state, well, in one case, quasi-official, in the second case, state-owned television three times. He was on the English language TV channel called Russia Today in August, speaking on the Georgia invasion of South Ossetia and how that was a London operation run through George Soros's employees, so to speak, in the Georgian government. And then in September, LaRouche was on for a short but extremely incisive interview on the financial meltdown, where LaRouche said to the interviewer on Russia Today television, this is not like the 1930s depression, this is like the 14th century. Then on October 5th, millions of people throughout Russia saw a 20-minute segment on the most popular weekly news program on Russian state television. It's called Vesti Nedeli, means news of the week, and it's on TV Rossiya. And this was a 20-minute section on the financial crisis on Wall Street and in the streets of the United States. They showed laid off people living in tent cities. They cut back to similar things going on in Europe. And they presented LaRouche for the explanation of why this was happening. In between there, on the 2nd of October, there was an interview in Kommersant, the leading business paper of Russia, with an important figure named Vladimir Yakunin. He's the CEO of Russian Railways, which is the state-owned corporation. He, in fact, was meeting with Putin today on something the Prime Minister Putin is very much engaged in, is which is how to save these projects that Russia has launched, like rail, road, other infrastructure construction, under the conditions of the crisis, because foreign investment and collaboration was an element. So in his October 2nd interview, Yakunin was asked, when did you realize there would be a financial crisis? And he replied, years ago. Then he said, I'm not making this up. I remember my first conversation with the American alternative economist, Professor LaRouche. He said to me, Vladimir, I can tell you with certainty that the economic crisis is already taking place. And then Mr. Yakunin went on to summarize LaRouche's analysis of the takedown of the physical economy and its replacement by a virtual economy, a bubble economy, that has led us to this pass. So those are just a few examples.
Yeah, just from these examples, it's clear that the ideas of LaRouche are getting widespread circulation. And you've been listening to Rachel Douglas from the Executive Intelligence Review. This is the LaRouche Show. We will take some email questions if they're pertinent. You can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. But make sure they're on our subject, because I want to make sure we have as much time as possible to get out this picture. I'd like to turn now to Tanu, who has been reporting some very similar kinds of developments in India. India, of course, is one of the four powers that Lyndon LaRouche has identified as critical for the calling into existence of a new Bretton Woods. Tana, why don't you just start by telling us why is India one of the four powers, and what do people in India think when they hear LaRouche talk about India as one of the four countries that are going to be needed to establish this new financial system?
Yeah, well, you know that LaRouche's connection with India goes way back. In fact, when India was virtually isolated and was not part of any of the Cold War sides and was a leader of the non-aligned movement, in 1980-81, around that time, LaRouche proposed a 40-year development program for India and to make India an agro-industrial superpower. That was the name of that document that we produced. And basically, it was based upon the fact that beside the location, geographical location of India, the India's capabilities that existed even then in 1980-81, India will be able to, if developed, will be able to provide enormous amount of leadership to mostly the developing nations and also to the large Eurasian landmass. We didn't talk about Eurasian landmass at that time, particularly because it was still Cold War was on. But that 40-year development program was basically centered around, you know, development of power, water, human resources, education, and agriculture. So basically those were the note points that he pointed out, and those remained even today exactly the note points that need to be addressed to. But in 1995-96, around that time, LaRouche, Mr. LaRouche and Mrs. LaRouche produced this Eurasian Landmass Development Program, Eurasian Land Bridge, and which identified at that time the Cold War was over, and identified at the time that with the Indian manpower and quite a bit of scientific and technological capabilities, Chinese manpower and Russian scientific capabilities, this entire landmass not only can be developed, but could be the engine of growth for the rest of the world. And it's, you know, they have a whole lot of different relationship with areas like Africa. They had never colonized Africa. And in South America and all that, so they would play a very key role in helping the world. At that point in time, Mr. LaRouche has already seen that the distortion that is done by in 1971 by sabotaging the Bretton Woods system is causing enormous amount of problem to the economy, and the bubbles were, you know, popping up everywhere. So his suggestion was that population-wise, this, you know, 1 billion of Indians and 1.2 billion of Chinese, and the Russians were, you know, at least 200, 250 million at the time, would be able to provide a great deal of technological scientific development, and they have enormous capabilities for industrial and agricultural and our production and all that. So India was included. Long back in 1980s, I think Mr. LaRouche had in his mind that India has to be brought to the forefront in order to have this to stabilize the world. The years of Mrs. Gandhi and previous to that Nehru and then Rajiv Gandhi and then Prime Minister Rao did some good work in India and the basics of the Indian economics, like India became an agricultural surplus nation, technologies in space and nuclear were developed to a certain extent, and India was also developing the information technology industry, and there were signs that the manpower in India is quite capable of handling the forefront of all the technological areas.
Well, Tanu, to what extent in recent years have Indian political leaders and economists been drawn into the idea of the post-industrial globalist economy? Is that something that...
Right.
Because India was making some money from the outsourcing that was being done in information technology.
Right.
To what extent was that a distortion for
it was, it was a massive distortion, and I have written extensively in EIR about that. What happened is this, a couple of things. One is this war on terror in 2001 created a political situation in India in which India started looking closer to the United States with the promises from the Bush administration that India will be helped very seriously in economic areas if India joins the war on terror, which India did. But the kind of help that the Bush administration was proposing and promising were basically, you know, promotion of free trade and free market things. Mm-hmm. Now, India has nationalized banks. India's banks are still nationalized. They have allowed some private banks to crop up, and they have allowed foreign banks to function there even as retail bankers. These are the concessions that have already been made. And there was enormous pressure over the years, I think before the war on terror, to open up the Indian economy for globalization. And one of the things that this administration, this Manmohan Singh administration, completely distorted the economy one way is that their reading of things was, to a certain extent, was I would say, emulation of the Chinese way of thinking, Chinese model. Mm-hmm. What do we in India, we call it the China model of development, which is basically, you know, you centralize all your capabilities of manpower and all that, and provide them with all the privileges and opportunities in order to produce things which can be exported outside. And now, once you seal off these areas, which Chinese did very successfully, the special economic zone and all that, those are where only skilled people can come and work and mm-hmm. stay. There was no problem with the labor problem or anything like that. And so technology and the American businessmen and European businessmen were putting their putting their facilities in there in order to get at a much cheaper wage and a 48-hour or 60-hour week manpower to produce things which can be then brought back to the United States, Europe, and can be sold at a much cheaper price.
Well, has the chaos on financial markets over the credit crunch and the things we've seen since July 2007, is that now causing a reevaluation of this model?
Well, I think the reevaluation of the model, the LaRouche factions within India had always been very opposed to this model, which was centered around the development of information technology and, shipping, basically getting the benefit of outsourced work from Europe and the United States. So what it was developing was basically a kind of a disparity. One of the things about Indian economy was going back to the as late as 1990s, as I was growing up and have seen, is that the disparity was not much. I mean, there was a middle class which would be considered as poor in the United States, and the difference between poor and middle class were always very little, very small, and the wages were never very high for the number one officer in the facility and for the even engineers and all that. So disparity was somehow not allowed to grow. But this system that was adopted, which was the China model system, that you make products which can be sold in West.
Dependence on exports.
Yeah, exports, and you will be given a very high wage. And that's why the disparity grew and those tensions were growing within the country. I think as far back as 2005, violences were cropping up. There were very strong Maoist movement has cropped up over the last 3 or 4 years. All were reflections of, basically, is this disparity. And the disparity was not being addressed to by this present administration. They were promising the people that in the rural areas, the infrastructure development will be done when we'll have X amount of foreign exchange reserves and the United States, and appealing to United States to invest something like $150 billion for infrastructure development. But none of that was realistic or it didn't occur. So naturally, the disparity grew and the tension between the population continued to grow. So it was coming to a point in which this needed to be addressed. Now the collapse that has happened in the last few months of the global economy, now the outsourcing will dry up. And already I heard today while I was talking to a friend in Delhi, he was telling me that the people are being forced out from work, people who are getting in a very, very good wage, they are now just without jobs, and this is only the beginning. More will come. Then another.
Tanu, you heard Rachel's report on the growth of the presence of Lyndon LaRouche in the media. I understand we recently had a very significant coverage of Lynn on an Indian. It was television news?
Yes, it was New Delhi Television, yes, the largest network. They had at 9 o'clock at night on Sunday, they have this News This Week. That is the name of it. It's a one-hour segment, and they pull in the week's news it has got about 10 to 15 million audience on this. And the first 15 minutes were dedicated to an interview that was carried out from New York live, hooked up with Lynn's residence, and simultaneously was shown in India. And this was basically on the collapse that is happening and the mistakes that are being made by this bailout system, bailout process that Paulson Bernanke was doing, and the massive crisis that is in front of us because of this huge derivative is hanging over us, like the Sophocles' sword, Democles' sword. And so basically this was, LaRouche was pointing out, that the crisis has only begun, and until unless it is being addressed to with a new global financial system, there is no solution to this. No matter what they say, there is no bailout of this thing.
And you mentioned before the idea of a LaRouche faction in India opposing the model that connects development with the outsourcing. Is this LaRouche faction in India moving toward the calling for a new Bretton Woods? Do we have that kind of motion in India now?
What they have succeeded in doing that in every morning in India, the Ministry of External Affairs, which is the foreign ministry, gets a briefing. So of the things that have happened overnight or whatever around the world. And all the LaRouche's presentations, LaRouche pack material, is every morning now is being given to the morning briefing to the Ministry of External Affairs. Now, this briefing goes around only within the embassies, Indian embassies all over the world. This does is not for public consumption, but it is being they have a representative of a friend of ours who handles this thing is now officially asked every morning for the briefing from Mr. LaRouche's outfit. So he does that every morning now.
Well, that's really quite amazing. You think about the India-Russia side of things, and we'll fill this in more in the next half hour. I'd like to bring Michael Kirsch in now. Michael, you've been listening to this the report from Rachel and from Tanu from India. What are your thoughts on this as a young organizer, someone who's back in Boston, getting back into the field again, and at the same time working on the Russian intelligence? What's your impression of this situation?
Well, the thing that was striking in my mind is that how you have these different cultural characteristics in which their response to LaRouche is being put through. And in the United States here, there's somewhat of a different thing that we are confronted with when we're trying to figure out how to push and pull and leverage the world situation in the United States in the direction we want to go. And that's the underlying axiomatic framework that we have to deal with here in the United States is somewhat different. And our movement has taken most recently a particular approach in trying to get at some of these things on the question of economics. So that's, I can elaborate some more on that, but that was the thing that struck me right away.
Sure. Well, it's ironic on the one hand that Lin is an American. In fact, he's the best tradition in America, the tradition of the Leibnizian elements in the founding fathers, Lincoln, Franklin, Roosevelt. And yet, in a sense, that's almost a foreign influence now, isn't it? I mean, you do work at Harvard, Boston University. The idea of the American system is a little bit more foreign now, isn't it?
Yeah, that's precisely what I was thinking, because, you know, we've been going to, we've been doing work at the State House, we've been calling up so different institutional people, organizing at Harvard Yard, in fact, and at Boston University. And what you're confronted with is something that you're realizing that in the economy, you're not just getting that these free trade policies, which have destroyed our economy and created for people this wide distinction between so-called economics and real living conditions, is not something that's just coming from nowhere. It's coming from the university system, and it's coming out of ideologies that are being pushed, which is why we're taking a particular approach in getting at these underlying axioms. I'll just give people a sensible example of this wide diversion in the way people look at this. We were at a city council meeting in Lowell, Massachusetts, and the city council was reviewing the types of approaches they were going to be taking to the crisis, and the city of Lowell is bankrupt, like any old hedge fund, completely bankrupt. And they're figuring out what they're going to be cutting. And what struck us was that when they're going through how they're going to have to double the cost for sewage for people that they already was $250. They raised it to $500 a month. They were talking about even raising it more. Hmm. Was that the distinction between the financial crisis and what they're faced with in terms of their budgeting is has nothing to do with the physical needs of the country. That there's this complete distinction between how do you have an economy for the population and these services that you need, and what the cause of the crisis is. It's the same thing up in the State House, where we were going door to door, reminding people that we had been warning them about this HBP, the banking systemic crisis last year with the HPPA. And again, there's a complete lack of understanding of what the basis for an economy is, which is this element of creativity. And the key element of creativity, which has been not taken into account, is in fact the cause of the crisis. And I can say more about what I'm thinking in terms of what is brought up now in Russia, India, and worldwide discussion.
Well, let me just ask you a specific question then, Michael. Are you finding that even though they don't know much, there's a growing reception for the discussion of these ideas than there was 6 months or a year ago?
That's definitely the case, and people are admitting that we're right. And I think the fear of the crisis is getting people to respond. But the underlying axioms remain, and that is why, yeah, as Lyndon LaRouche is now writing this new piece, is that even though when a crisis comes, you have people, their underlying axioms become crushed. What they thought was true is no longer true. The only question is now, what will they replace it with? Will they flee into wild fundamentalism? Will they grab some other axiom that can replace their one they thought was true? Or will we be able to get people to see the crisis, make an opportunity to discover what this actual American system policy was that is now forgotten?
Yeah, I can tell from my own organizing among American political layers, Democratic and Republican, many older people who are still in positions of influence, there's no question now in the United States among these networks, including in the Congress, that Lynn has been right. The question is whether they draw that out to the full implications of what it means to have a total breakdown of the economic system and financial system. And are they ready to move against the beliefs that they think the people have? And I think what you're going to find, we had a town meeting here in Los Angeles last night, and we had over 100 people were there, including about 20 contacts who were youth. And we're beginning to see an uptick in people who want to solve the problem and are willing to question their axioms. Now, let me get back to Rachel and Tanu, and then Michael, stand by because I'm going to want to come back to you before the end of the program. But Rachel, with this picture that we've gotten from you and Tanu in two of the four powers that Lynn has identified, there are going to be some decisions that have to be made, maybe leading into the November 15th conference. There's also, Lynn has written quite extensively recently on this Russia question, especially around recognizing, I guess one of the axioms you might say that's problematic is it the United States or the British that are the main problem? Shed some light on that for us.
This picks up just from what Michael was saying about the fundamental axioms of economy. What is the characteristic of the American system as we know it, who haven't allowed our historical memory to be completely wiped out? It's not just a different set of rules of the game. It's not a different way of arranging your same bad financial policies. It's something completely different, resting on a different conception of what a human being is. Michael said creativity as the font of economic progress. That goes right to the core of what LaRouche is addressing to the Russians in everything that he's writing. Look, this question of the United States comes up again and again and again because Russia knows that something has to change. There has to be a new financial architecture. There's a ready impulse to say, okay, but the United States has been so awful. After all, the Paulson plan belongs to Paulson, and it is the Bush administration, and look what they've done in Iraq for the last 8 years. And, you know, Obama wants to get Ukraine and Georgia into NATO also. So aren't they all just against us, and aren't they adversarial? And why don't we set up a multipolar financial system with 7 reserve currencies and different rules of the game, and the United States can be one, but they're going to be down off on the side somewhere. And LaRouche has been just emphatic that any attempt to have a new Bretton Woods without the United States, not just there, but there as itself, there as representing the American system with our constitutional conception of how you generate credit for the promotion of development in the common, in the general welfare. Any attempt to find a modus vivendi without the United States is not only not going to work, it's going to accelerate the plunge into a dark age. Now, interestingly, I can tell you, Harley, one of the things that we just put out in the Russian language is a very short commentary LaRouche issued on the 15th of October, which was in response to an article by the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. And so this was something coming out of what seemingly a different context, that is not on the financial architecture per se, but on strategic relations. And Lavrov was talking about the importance of not going into a totally adversarial relationship with the United States. And he concluded his article by saying, "I would add that everyone needs the America of Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy." And LaRouche wrote the remark on it, in which he said, "The statement by Lavrov is of crucial importance for every U.S. patriot seeking a present way out of the general breakdown crisis," which has been aggravated by the bailout and Bush signing on to the bailout. So now that's on the kind of strategic diplomatic level. But on the four powers, again and again, and since I was with LaRouche in Moscow in May of 2007, he gave interviews on Russian web TV then, he was saying, four powers, it must be four powers. The United States must approach Russia, India, China with an FDR quality of policy, with what FDR brought into Bretton Woods at the beginning of that conference. There were some compromises afterwards, but Roosevelt's conception of a non-colonial and anti-colonial world, sovereign nation states, operating in what John Quincy Adams called in the previous century a community of interest. And so the question arises from the Russians, well, Mr. LaRouche, you say that, but the U.S. governments that we know aren't coming with that. And LaRouche says, well, why don't you just consider for a moment, my dear Russian friends, that if you express the need for that, for that United States, that in itself becomes a factor on the thinking of leading circles in the United States. And so LaRouche is working on that line and a lot more having to do with these axioms of economic policy and really getting under the skin of his Russian friends by insisting that they look at the history of where their own assumptions about economics came from, not just the last 10 years of International Monetary Fund monetarism, but the
Rachel, there's a lot of this kind of discussion on, I guess, the Russian equivalent of blogs.
Oh, of course, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for heaven's sake, the president of Russia now has a blog. but no, seriously, this past week, for example, Stanislav Menshikov, famous Russian economist who's been on this program before, EIR put out his book a year and a half ago, The Anatomy of Russian Capitalism. He wrote a brilliant article called The Crisis Leaps Across the Planet, which readers of EIR will be able to see. We've just published it in this latest issue. But he wrote it in Russian, and he argued gave a very cogent account of how the crash, the systemic crisis had developed, and how LaRouche was right. LaRouche was the person who forecast this. Here's how LaRouche developed it. Whole interesting situation of LaRouche's analysis. And at the end, he went through the four-power proposal and LaRouche's new Bretton Woods, which starts with putting the whole existing speculative evil system through bankruptcy. That is, not bringing in the people who created it to now crisis manage it.
Rachel, if we have any Russian people who read Russian, where would they find the LaRouche Russian website?
It's LaRouchePub.com/Russian.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we're posting new material all the time on that now.
Yes. And the other thing is that we have a network of friends and supporters throughout Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, who subscribe to our material. They subscribe to the RSS feed on our Russian site or on our English sites on LaRouchePack.com, and they get the updates and they crossfire them constantly. So Professor Menshikov's article on what LaRouche proposes appeared in a weekly newspaper called Slovo, and within 2 days it had also appeared on 3 or 4 other leading sites and at least 24 blogs and forums. This happens with every single thing we put out.
Okay, now let me get back to Tanu, because I think this question of where India is headed, where India will go in this next month. The Prime Minister of India was just on a tour, I believe, to China. He met with the Prime Minister of Japan. To what extent do you think the Singh government is going to be rethinking its economic policy? And India has been invited to this G20 meeting taking place in Washington. Do you have any idea what the Indian government's inclination will be at that meeting?
Well, it's shaping at this point in time, but there are indications that some things are sinking in. Now, whether they're going to react on the basis of that in a positive way or not, or they will sit tight, I cannot say that. I have no way to say one way or the other. But a couple of things drew my interest recently. One is this: Singh had gone to Japan, and instead of talking about financial help and all that kind of thing, what he was interested in, or two areas he was interested in, and he was succeeded in getting one, is that India wants to build an industrial corridor. It's about 1,200 miles long from Delhi to Mumbai, which was formerly Bombay. Now, this industrial corridor will be initially $90 billion, which the government of India will put in, but it will be centered around a railroad, which will be carrying it's called the freight corridor, which will be the high-speed rail will run from Delhi to Mumbai and Mumbai to Delhi. And this will be provided by the Japanese using the Japanese technology. So Japan has a pretty good and a fast rail, high-speed rail technology, and their bullet train and all that. So they got that one. They got that $5 billion. This is the highest single project investment that Japan had ever made in any country. So that shows that there is a certain realization that the real economy must be protected, and money should not be taken and put into this, to pay up the debt and things like that. That's one thing. The second thing was that from there he traveled to the ASEM meeting, which was scheduled in Beijing over the Thursday, Friday, the last 2 days. There was the European leaders were there, and China and India. And the European leaders, the center place was taken by Sarkozy. And I was reading through it, although I have to read more. And if I get the transcript, then I would be more sure about what he was trying to present. But there are, from what I read, it was very clear that what Sarkozy was trying to do was to garner the support of the Asians, which basically China and India, in order to go with stronger muscle at this G20 meeting in November 15 to present a common front on behalf of Asia and Europe.
And I think also South Korea,
South Korea
plays
is
an
there.
Important role here. The,
right.
We had an article on our LaRouche PAC site and in the EIR the last couple of weeks on how the current president of South Korea, during his talks in Moscow, was oriented not only to important real economy projects, but some kind of coordination with Russia. And
right.
then he's also in an interview, actually, with Le Figaro a couple days ago, President Lee of South Korea discussed his thinking about how his activities overlap those of France and also with China and India in approaching the finance side.
Last week I had Jacques Cheminade, the leader of the LaRouche movement in France, on the LaRouche show. And Jacques had also described in great detail the coverage in France of Cheminade, of LaRouche,
right.
and including his debate with de Boissieu, who's a top official of the French government, on this question of a new Bretton Woods. And Jacques said, keep an eye on this question of Sarkozy coming out against derivatives. And upon his return from Asia, Sarkozy gave a speech, I think yesterday, where he was very strong on this question of no speculation, no derivatives, and direct state investment into physical production. So I assume, Tanu, that's the kind of discussion that was going on with President Singh.
Yes, because, Harley, one thing that that the Indians, and even though Manmohan Singh as a leader I consider is a very weak leader, will not accept is the cutting out the United States from in the whole global financial arrangement system, and to play hand in glove with the United States would be definitely the Indian intent. But one thing that was there in this Sarkozy's proposal at the same time is that the strengthening of IMF, you know, global monitoring service and all that kind of thing. While the discussion was going on, which was interesting, that Wen Jiabao asked Manmohan Singh to intervene, and he said, Dr. Singh, since you are a trained economist, what's your view on this? And Manmohan Singh, and unfortunately, said the right thing at that point in time, said that no matter what the financial system comes out, the global financial system, one key element of that should be infrastructure development in the developing nations. That should be a key in this whole thing. Mm-hmm. So I would consider that these are some of the, you know, filtering of our efforts of and LaRouche influence has even reached that point of Manmohan Singh, who is otherwise, you know, had promoted an economic system in India, which is, you know, basically a China model. So I think that that's happening. And just for your interest, I must point out that Cheminade's TV broadcast in France shows up in all the Indian media very heavily, and which I find very interesting.
Very important.
Many of the things we're talking about, by the way, we don't have one of our China desk people in this discussion, but are frequently picked up on Xinhua and People's
right.
Daily, the leading publications mm-hmm. of China. There's been coverage of Mr. LaRouche's warnings, his current statements there as well in the recent period. I have a question for Michael, if I may.
Sure. I was just going to say, a year ago, Mr. LaRouche was out here in Los Angeles for a very significant conference with China scholars from mm-hmm. the mainland, from Taiwan, and the United States. And before you do that, Rachel, let me just tell our listeners that you can go to the EIR, the LaRouchePub.com, to see some of the articles that Rachel and Tanu are talking about. But if you really want to get the material in depth that you're going to need to be able to play a role in shaping this fight, you're going to need a subscription to the Executive Intelligence Weekly, which is the online weekly publication of Executive Intelligence Review. And you can call our office. You can go on to LaRouchePub.com to get the information for that. Also on LaRouchePub.com, we have the archives of the LaRouche show. And so you can play this show for your friends who missed it or any other recent program, including the interview with Cheminade last week and an interview with Lyndon LaRouche, which I did about 4 weeks ago. So, Rachel, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to ask Michael, I mean, besides your work in organizing in the Boston area and nationally through your scientific work with the basement team, in the United States, you've also been involved in an a discussion process with young people and young leaders in Russia, which is beginning to take up pick up steam. So I'm interested. I think people would find interesting how how the people you're talking with, you know, react to the fact that it's not just Lyndon LaRouche alone, but they're actually talking to a movement in the United States.
Yeah, well, I think that my sense is that, one, people are excited about a responsibility to represent a policy which has been right for 40 years. And they've also, people are excited, one, I mean, given that responsibility, but the responsibility is something else, which is that that Russia and the U.S. have, for various historical reasons, both the identities of a people that do not want to be enslaved by any empire, in particular the British Empire, and we have identities which a lot of people from other countries don't have, that you can do anything, that you can accomplish anything. And so for a collaboration between now younger generation to look at, I mean, you look at a Russia that's building itself out of the hell of the oligarchical takeover of the 90s and the looting of the whole economy there, and a young generation here, which is taking on this axiomatic foundation, which has destroyed our legacy. We have I think the big thing is that we're looking at it not from the standpoint of a practical question of solving the immediate crisis, but in the sense that we can, if Russia and the U.S. unite once again, clear the way of the old Cold War stuff, clear the way of the Marxian economic doctrines and the British free trade economic doctrines, we can, in fact, create a level of scientific discussion which will make Russia the keeper of the Vernadskyan conception of development of raw materials in the planet, and with an American scientific basis from Alexander Hamilton and Leibniz. And I think the other thing is that one thing we're discussing with people is the fact that our countries, in fact, come from the same Leibnizian scientific tradition, that Peter the Great, who went on a European expedition, dressed up as a peasant, among the other
a 7-foot-tall peasant
with a flowing
a
red beard,
7-foot-tall peasant who worked in the shipyards of the Netherlands and studied the scientific applications of the artisans of Europe, and actually made his way to visit with Sophie Charlotte, who at that time was being advised with Leibniz. Whether or not he met with Leibniz is unclear to me, but it was a Leibnizian tradition which Alexander Hamilton and Ben Franklin and others implemented through the conception that Leibniz writes about in the New Essays in the section on power and freedom on the pursuit of happiness, through the implementation of the idea of implementing the productive powers of labor of an economy as the basis for a credit system. So that unified tradition between our countries is, in fact, now something which, if we can get to that root, which is what Lyndon LaRouche is outlining as the root that you need to go to, then we can have the kind of revolution. But it really does have to be a revolution that changes fundamental axioms, that this new Bretton Woods it won't work unless there's an application of a new social principle worldwide. And without
is,
that,
and the key point, Michael, is...
Yeah.
The key point is a principle. We're less than 2 minutes. I want to get a quick response from both Rachel and Tanu. Do you expect the Russian and Indian governments to do anything in particular at this November 15th meeting, or is it just a question of needing more development? Rachel?
I think it's too soon to say.
Uh-huh.
Really, no. I think we've got there's 2.5 weeks until that meeting. There's, 5 more things that we're intending to publish in Russian and get into the mix between now and then, including the Russian voiceover of Lyndon LaRouche's October 1st webcast presentation. And I do believe that those are a factor in defining the potential. for the answer to that question.
Well, there is one thing that is definitely will be said over there, whether it will be accepted or not, I do not know. But what the Indian, what New Delhi would do is definitely very strongly oppose the globalization. And that would be there, that this our reforms, our controls and things like that, regulations and all that, they should be there and they should be allowed to be kept. Every sovereign nation should have that right.
Tanu, very quickly, is there still a strong anti-British imperial tendency among the Indian elite?
Oh, yes, very much so. There is no question about that. Yes.
All right. Well, there's
look at the free trade as the British looting system that was implemented by East India Company.
And as Michael just pointed out, that is something which unites the three countries, the United States, Russia, and India.
Yeah.
This has been a really fascinating discussion. Thank you very much, Tanu, Rachel, and Michael, for joining us on the LaRouche Show today. We'll be back next Saturday and every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.